Beautiful people, welcome to Fanti, the podcast for all those complex and complicado conversations about the gray areas in our lives. I am off the rest times dose, Travell Anderson.
And I am 2009's hardest working broke bitch you ever met in your life, Jarrett Hill. We are going to be getting
she
into
got money,
a I mean, I'm not you, but it's fine. We are
And you're not, but that's all right.
Like, in the first minute, like, really? We just started.
I'm sorry.
Today, we are going to be getting into a conversation about college and degrees with one of our faves who's coming back on the show. Dr. Charles Davis will be here just a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But first, it's time for us to pass the popcorn.
Yes, so over the weekend, Jerrod Carmichael, who you might know from the canceled Too Soon, The Carmichael Show, released a new comedy special on HBO Max. It's called Rothaniel, okay? And it is a much watch, in my opinion, particularly for the Black folks. So for today's Pass the Popcorn, we want to talk about it. You might have seen headlines over the weekend that the comedian comes out as gay in the special, and he does, but that is just the tip of the iceberg, as they say, of the wondrousness on display in this special. Okay, now we're going to actually be on Pop Culture Happy Hour soon discussing the show in more detail, but we're itching to tell you all some things, okay? So, Jarrett, I'm going to turn it over to you first. Tell the people what you thought, what you felt.
I mean, I thought it was fine.
Okay, great.
No, I think I immediately called you after finishing it.
Yeah, you did.
Like, within minutes of finishing it, I was not 10 minutes in, and I was like, I am in love with this. Like, I think it is brilliant and genius and so smart and so, like, relatable. I have to wonder what it's doing for all the Black queer folks that have things in development right now. Like, if it's helping or hurting, I don't know. I would hope that it's helping to be able to have more conversations about, like, the nuance of our stories, because I think that nuance is something that we spend a lot of time here talking about. And I think that Rothaniel was able to kind of show us, like, yes, I'm a Black gay man, but, like, I have so many other layers to my story that are beyond who I'm sleeping with. It was really, really great. I really loved it.
It's interesting to hear you articulate what you got from it, because I did not necessarily get that, but I see how you got what you got, right? But this is the beauty of the special, right? So I tweeted out my little, you know, mini review, and I was just like, you know, it's super vulnerable, it's funny, it's communal, it's relatable, especially for those of us who knows what it's like to choose freedom. It's a marvel of Black queer storytelling. And then I ended it, I put a button on the message by saying, it's like Nanette for niggas.
I don't know who she is.
Now, I don't know if y'all seen Nanette, right? But that's the Netflix special that Hannah Gatsby did a few years ago, that when it came out, she and the special was, like, regarded as like, super, super good because of how specific her experience was that she was sharing, how much she kind of blew up the conventions of what a comedy special is supposed to be, because it was so serious and it was so, so vulnerable. Similarly to what we see in Rothaniel, where Jerrod is not really telling jokes, right? There's
right.
not really that, like, comedy, what's that, punchline? What's it?
Set up punchline.
That thing, yes. It's not really that. But what I loved is that it's comedic in the way that, like, Black folks telling stories is always comedic, right? Like, one of the things that I love about what we do as a people is that, like, you always gonna be entertained by how we string some words together. And to see him do it in the context, right, of not only telling us how he came out, right, to his family, but also coming out there in person to all of these people who did not know, right, was just, like, super interesting and super fresh. And I just really loved it. I don't want to go on too long because we're going to get deeper into it on Pop Culture Happy Hour, but it really is a wonder to have witnessed. I will say, slight disclaimer, not even disclaimer, you know, there is a bit of, you know, misogyny that pops in. There's a bit of, you know, ableism that pops in. We got to say it. We got to say it, even though we like You know, the special overall, we got a note.
I mean, there's also like a conversation about interracial relationships that is interesting about this this piece and talking about, I don't want to give away too much, but like, I think that if for those of you that haven't seen it, I think you should definitely check it out before the Pop Culture Happy Hour episode comes out next week. And, you know, hopefully we can get Gerard to be on the show here. But like, I'm really, really excited about this piece. I've already watched it twice. I will certainly be watching it again. I think there is something really unique and special about the way that Black folks tell stories. I think human beings across the diaspora of humanity have like this connection to storytelling that's really important. But I certainly think there's something about the way that Black folks tell stories that is unique and specific, and probably why we're writing a whole book called Historically Black Phrases.
Sure is.
But like, I just think it was really, really special. So I would encourage everybody to go check it out. And again, we'll be on Pop Culture Happy Hour next week talking about this special, and hopefully we can get Gerard on. We're going to take a quick break though. When we come back, we are going to get into the academy, the academia, college, and what we have mixed feelings about. That's coming up next.
Or Coolidge, as my granny used to say, to describe prison.
Okay. Well, and that. Don't go anywhere. One of the things that's been most important to me is my me time. And if you're looking to upgrade yours, enter Brooklinen, comforters in chief and creators of the softest, most luxurious home essentials, perfect for relaxation. By working directly with their suppliers, Brooklinen is able to cut out the luxury markups and passes along those savings to their customers. So you get their incredible products at a reasonable cost.
Baby, I lay down on my Brooklinen sheets and I feel like Queen Latifah in Last Holiday when she go to that hotel and she's just, you know, like what? Orgasming on the sheets just because they feel so good, so luxurious. Baby, that's what Brooklinen gives me on a personal level, okay? That's all I'm saying. They have new products, new colors and patterns all the time. Sheets, towels, robes. They got whatever you need, honey. So gift the comfort refresh you deserve for yourself and maybe for somebody else. And you can get it for less at Brooklinen. Go to brooklinen.com and use promo code FANTIE to get $20 off your purchase of $100 or more. That's brooklinen.com and enter promo code FANTIE for $20 off. That's Brooklinen, the curators of comfort, honey.
You know that Travelle and I do enjoy partaking here in the state of California because we can. And many of you in other states can as well. If you're into marijuana or would like to try it and maybe thinking about microdosing, this is for you. If you search around a bit on the internet, you'll find all sorts of people are microdosing to feel healthier and perform better. Our show today is sponsored by Microdose Gummies. Microdose Gummies deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC to help you feel just the right amount of good. I can tell you for myself, I'm a big fan of Lumi Labs and these gummies. They're really tasty, which is not always the case if you're having anything that has THC in it. They're delicious with all kinds of different flavors. And I really enjoy that they not only taste good, but they're effective, right? You can just pop one or two and they're going to take you into a nice little coast that I thoroughly enjoy.
Yes, you can use it for a creative boost. You can use it to take yourself to sleep, to relieve some pain, anxiety, some after workout recovery, whatever you need. Now go on, do your research now. We want you to do your research. Now, okay, and in that research, you will find that microdose is available nationwide. You can learn more about microdosing THC just by doing a quick search online, or you can go directly to microdose.com, and you can use the code FANTIE to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description, but again, that's microdose.com and code FANTIE.
Welcome back to Fanti. As if on cue this week's episode, the Biden administration has announced that the federal loan repayment pause will be extended through August 31st, which prompted us to go into a brief praise, calling on Joe to just go head on and do what he said he would do. Please. In his word. Hallelujah. Do it now.
Cancel it, Lord. Yes.
But all of this brings us to the growing question of the value placed on academia and other institutions that are pretty commonly understood and expected. Data shows that over the last decade, undergraduate college enrollment has slowly but steadily started to dip after peaking in 2010 and 2011. To be clear, we're still more educated than ever, but the numbers are starting to slip. In addition, we're seeing more Gen Xers deprioritizing getting a driver's license. Adding millennials in, we're seeing both are getting married later and divorcing less and having children later. This made me want to have a conversation with friends and also Travel about college degrees and what their modern place is in society. So I called up our returning champion, assistant professor at University of Michigan, focusing on issues of race, racism, and resistance, Dr. Charles Davis. Welcome back to Fanti.
Such a pleasure to be here. Always good to be in y'all's company. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Okay, so we want to let y'all know that we're going to have a bit of a complex and complicado format here. We won't be doing the fan and the anti, but to get things started, Charles, tell us, what was your academic journey? What did your movement through the academia look like?
I mean, how much time we got?
Uh-oh.
Right.
Come on, Dr. Davis. Yes.
Right. I mean, I was for show on the Kanye West plan. You know, I was an undergraduate student at the Florida State University in Tallahassee. You see me repping FAMU. I want to shout out our HBCUs. Certainly got all the education I needed in that particular city on both campuses. But as an undergraduate student, you know, I was really just trying to find my way, like a lot of us. Right. And it definitely was one of those intervention moments where you get called to the, you know, dean of students office. And it's like, look, Mr. Davis, you got a bunch of credits in English. So is this what you're majoring in? I was like, I mean, I guess that sounds good. Right. And part of that, you know, my mother was an English teacher for 25 years. And so I come from a long line of people in a particular literary tradition, but it's something I enjoyed. But I was also minoring in Africana studies. And that set me on a different path of just exploring sort of like, you know, what Hannah Arendt would call the life of the mind. And so I started looking at graduate school. I'd met a few sort of key Black professors, you know, being at a PWI, we know how important that resource is, who even got into my head the idea of being a professor and what that meant. But I wasn't quite sure, right? I was sort of in this tug of war between the thing that I thought I wanted to do and the thing I thought was going to make me money, right? And this is part of the dilemma in college. So, you know, coming out in English, I was like, well, I don't really want to do, you know, teaching. I'd already taught music for 4 years, which is my initial interest going into school. And so I picked up a master's in marketing communications. And that was sort of the track that I felt I was going to be on, right? Sort of marrying sort of my love for writing, graphic design, and things I explored in college into taking a role in advertising. So I spent some time working in advertising as a strategist, but the academy was still calling me. You know, I felt that advertising wasn't really the best place for my skill set. It was almost anti-intellectual, right? With the way that we were thinking about selling people stuff. And so I went back to school again to get that master's again on that Kanye plan. Hoping my degrees is going to keep me warm. surely they did not. And despite having applied to doctoral programs for 4 different admission cycles, getting denials from 14 different programs, I finally was admitted to a handful of programs and then pursued a PhD in higher education at the University of Arizona with a cognate focus in anthropology. And so that was sort of my trajectory over, let's see, I was a freshman coming up on, 20 years ago. 2002 was my freshman year. Graduated from my PhD program in 2015. And so since then, I've been, you know, an educator at the post-collegiate level for what I guess the better part of the last, what is that, 7 years or so now?
That's what's up. Okay. Now, Travel, you know, we've talked about your decisions about college, you know, the trials of you decided Morehouse and then you decided Stanford. You talk to us? Talk to us.
Morehouse
about
decided for me. Thank you very much. I was chosen, as they say. Sorry,
not do it. Okay, well, give us your collegiate background.
Oh, I hope everybody knows that was a joke. Okay, I have a little complex situation, right? My mom initially went to college, but she dropped out of college when she had my brother and my older sister. And so technically, in a weird way, I'm a first generation college student. She ended up going back to school online while I was in college. But I say that to say I went to Morehouse. I was one of those people who, like, the expectation was that you were going to go to college, right? That's just like the thing, because I had always been like super smart. And so like it was the thing. I feel like the generation right before me in the family, it wasn't necessarily the expectation that anybody would go to college after high school. But for my group, it was like, oh, all of y'all is going to school. So I went to Morehouse because they gave me the most scholarship money. That is literally how I made my decision. And it was cute or whatever. And so because of that scholarship, I did not have any loans freshman year, because I know we're going to get into that part of this discussion. And then by the end of senior year, I looked up and it was like, okay, well, so what you gonna do professionally, honey? You done took all these classes. You called yourself a sociologist or whatever that means.
And you still like to call yourself that now. So,
well, because it adds a little, you know, a little razzle dazzle.
There you go.
The work. You know, but I looked up and I was like, the most consistent thing that I've been doing since high school at this point is like journalism. Let's go to grad school, because all of the previous like journalism interested folks at Morehouse went to Columbia for grad school. So that's why I went to grad school. Didn't know what the fuck I was doing. Went to Stanford again because they gave me the most money, but it wasn't enough money, so I took out all these loans to cover that. It was a one-year program, though. And so she has a master's in communications with a focus and specialization in journalism from Stanford University. Darling, whatever.
There's so much shoulder work. There's so much shoulder work that y'all are missing that I'm sorry that you're missing what's happening on camera right now.
It was impeccable.
Thank you, Charles.
It was a lot.
Thank you, Charles, for affirming me.
I mean, what else do you want from me? Jesus.
Jarrett, tell the people about your academic pursuits.
Yeah. So my academic background has been like really challenging. So my career started in 11th grade, which we'll talk about a little bit later because Travell wants to drag me about that. But like my college career, like I wasn't ready after high school to leave town yet, right? I was like, I was dealing with some things and I just wasn't ready. So I went to junior college in the Bay Area. And I did that for 2 years and then I transferred into Clark Atlanta University. I went to Clark Atlanta where I was studying mass media arts, radio, TV, film, and because of some things to do with my loan and the person who secured my loan, I ended up having to leave Clark Atlanta. It was really expensive, obviously, going to a private school. So then I went to Kennesaw State University, which is north of Atlanta in Georgia, which was like a 2-hour commute. And it was really, really difficult and challenging for me. And something that I was saying to Travell in our run-up to this meeting that we've talked about before, but Troy was like, what? Was I dropped out my senior year of college, right? So like I have like the 4-year college experience and I think people kind of assume that I have a degree, but like I had to drop out my 4th year. I couldn't afford it. I had some significant mental health things happening and I had work stuff. And so that was like the seed that planted for me, like what became like a significant experience of imposter syndrome over the course of my adult career, my adult life, I should say. And now it's bizarre to me because one of the schools that I was considering going back to finish my degree was USC. And so now to be a professor in the program that I would have been, to be a professor in the program that I would have been a student in is still a lot for me to wrap my mind around. And a part of the reason that being a professor now is bizarre and weird to me after 20 years as a journalist, right? And so that's been an interesting thing for me, but like my relationship with academia has always been really mixed because of having to drop out my last year. And it's made for challenging relationships based on how I felt about that and what it did to me, but also what it did for me. So we all have very different backgrounds and experiences with college and the academy, if you will. I want to talk about a couple of different pieces of our relationships with academia and how we feel about them, right? We are clear on the reasons that people go to college. We have a narrative in this country and, you know, a lot of reasons why a lot of folks prioritize college in the way that they do. And the first thing I want to talk about is the debt. Right. We just talked about how the student loan debt is getting paused until later on this year. And a lot of folks have been saying, you know, do it, Joe, come on. But like, I want to know, what has the experience of college debt been like and how has it impacted your adult life? Charles, we'll let you start off.
Yeah, I mean, that's a real question, Chevelle. I appreciate you sort of talking about that 1-year master's situation. Right. So for me, you know, one thing my parents sort of guaranteed for all of their children is that they would make sure that we got through undergrad. And that was like, you know, a big thing, both of whom, you know, had the benefit of being college educated. My father went to Tuskegee Institute, now Tuskegee University, which is also where he grew up. And then my mother similarly bounced around. So actually, it's ironic for me to be a professor at Michigan, because that's where she was her freshman year and also stopped out and had to leave. And then later, you know, sort of completed her education elsewhere and did a master's online. But they're like, cool. So for graduate school, you kind of on your own. right? And so my first master's, it was sort of a combination of working with like some, you know, lower loans. And I didn't really have any experience with this whole enterprise, right? As someone who had college paid for in part by scholarship and also, you know, through the benefit of my parents. So of course I'm like, oh, you got money? Yeah, I'll take that, right? And doing God knows what with all that money in addition to paying for school stuff. So I had like a little bit of change there. But then, you know, again, my infinite wisdom also went to a prestigious private, you know, institution, arguably, at the University of Pennsylvania. I did a 1 year's master's in education there. And 90% of my debt to this day is still from that 1 year master's program. And part of what I've learned, and also as a professor of higher education, what we understand is that enrollment management, right, is like a science. It's the way that institutions determine how they're going to make part of their money or a good portion of their money through tuition. And what I didn't understand is that master's programs are really a scam, right? Because what happens is that the revenue that comes in the form of master's programs is what ends up subsidizing a lot of these professional schools. So as some may know, like with a PhD, you really should be getting a doctorate if it's not paid for, because they have funds to be able to pay for those programs. But part of what underwrites that are master's students. And so, again, not knowing a lot of this, I felt a certain kind of way coming out. You know, I was literally paying tuition on a payment plan until the week of graduation when I was at Penn. And I still owe them money. Right. And so thinking about that now with regard to like our own finances is like, yeah, this is a bill that I've had to pay like $900-something a month every single month. Right. Which is like a good chunk of change. And then you know, bring that in if you're partnered and then what that means for your like overall finances. Like my wife also has loans. And so that experience has been interesting trying to navigate even with our own relationships to money, but then like, what does it mean? And like how we carry that debt and is it something we can actually ever get rid of? And so one of those things that's informed, you know, sort of our approach as adults now being parents, but like immediately, like as soon as our daughter was born, like that 529 account, which is basically education savings, like we started that immediately because the rising cost of college at this point, unless, you know, if I'm still working at an institution by the time our daughter goes to school, if she don't go there, I don't know where she's going to go, because the way this thing is set up, like I might be able to pay for 2 years, right? You might need to start at a junior college and then be able to transfer because the costs are just like insurmountable.
I feel like a lot of the discourse that I hear around like college, going to school, is around the student loan part. It's around the debt part that many of us end up incurring. Do you have any, also for you, Jared, do y'all have any regrets about like pursuing the educational choices that you did or to the extent that you did because of the debt that you now have?
I mean, I'll defer to Jared.
Yes and no. I mean, as I look back now, like being able to get my own loan to go to Clark Atlanta wasn't something that I was like seriously considering at the time. I was 20 or 19 or whatever I was at that time, trying to figure out how to do this last year. But also like the program that I was in was changing, right? Like some of the professors that I was really excited to have were leaving. And I didn't know what that meant for that program and what it was going to look like. And you want me to take on another, I think it was $26,000 of debt, somewhere around there. And so it was hard to make that kind of a decision, and going to a state school was just going to be significantly less expensive. But like, I still have those loans like staring at me, right? And I still think to myself, like, that year that I did at the state school was just completely shit, right? And it was like, damn, I wish I didn't take out all that debt. So it's definitely something that I think about as a person who is, I turned 37 this month, right? And I'm thinking about when I want to retire and what I want to do financially and what my financial goals are. And I still have that kind of looming over me, as, you know, many, many Americans do. So it's definitely something in my mind. I don't know that I would use the word regret, but it's certainly something that, you know, kind of lives on as a frustration.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think for me, I don't regret the decision. What I think about is that I wish I had enough information to be informed, to exercise a certain type of agency that said I understood what I was getting myself into, right? And I think that's part of it too, is that there's such a veil over like the process and the implications of the decisions, especially for young people, many of whom are first generation, who can't ask their parents, right? Like how this stuff is supposed to work. Almost in the same thing of the credit card scams that was run on our campuses, right? For a box of pizza, and somebody's gonna give you a credit card application. You don't even know what that's gonna mean for you, much less these loans, right? Or more importantly, how institutions, right, use the loan system in many ways to profit off the backs of people who in many ways will never be in a position to pay them back. And the institutions own nothing, right? So I think for me, that was kind of the realization. Because again, I'm in academia, so part of my trajectory makes kind of like linear sense. But again, like I think I would have been, if I would have been more informed, I think if I would have understood that institutional prestige is socially constructed, right? Like I don't have to go to Penn. I could have gone somewhere else that may have cost less money and give me the same opportunities, you know, in some ways. So I think all of those are the things I think about in decisions that I make. And part of why, you know, I do the work that I do is to help sort of clarify, right? Like what really is going on with these things when I talk to young people who are considering college, or when people send, you know, their kids to me to do basically like guidance counseling, because like, you work at a college, you know how this works. I'm like, I mean, I know some of it, I don't know all of it, right? And so I think that's kind of like the critical piece, is like how much information we're really given, how much truth is being told, so we can make an informed decision.
Well, and I know for myself, the debt also became a source of like trauma and consternation, right? Because it was, well, I paid this money, right? And I did this thing, and like starting to feel beholden to the person who did that, right? Who like put their name on the line and all that kind of stuff. Then like for it to become what it became with me having to leave school and all that, then I was like, well, what good was your money, right? Like I didn't even get to finish the program. And then that like made the relationship contentious for a long time. And so like the money that kind of hangs over an individual and their credit score and their financial trajectory, but also over that relationship, like the money became a thing. And I still don't even know that it's not a thing anymore, but it's something that loomed for a really long time and has had like long lasting effects.
That's interesting to hear both of you say that. Because for me, well, one, that linguistic reframing you did there, Charles, wonderful. Really appreciate it.
Come through.
But for me, I maxed out three different loans for grad school because, similar to what you said, Charles, I did not have as much information as I probably should have had. But also with me driving cross country to go to Stanford, not knowing anyone there, I was like, I need as much coin in my pocket as possible for whatever happens. Mm-hmm. So like, I happily, yeah, you know, yep, sign me up. But also there was, for me at least, that like expectation of debt for school, to where I was like, this is what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to take out loans, right? Like, this is how you do this thing. And I already lucked up, right, by not having loans for undergrad. So, yeah, we could do this. I signed this $50,000 total or whatever. And only recently, right, have been able to, like, legitimately, like, pay them down or, like, clear them because I got a book deal, right? But everybody don't get book deals, right? But I often think about, if I were to do it all over again with what I know now, would I still go to Stanford, right? And, you know, I don't know if I would. I just don't. Like, I'm staring at this damn Stanford degree right now, and I just don't know if it is worth the paper that it rests on, you know? And at the same time, I would not have had my first job be at the Los Angeles Times if I did not meet the recruiter while I was a student at Stanford University.
So
right?
That's the thing, right? It's like part of what you understand to a certain extent is you're paying for access to a network, right?
That's it.
And that was kind of my thing going in, was knowing like, okay, Penn is a place where people go that do certain types of things that I'm interested in doing. They have a network, mm-hmm, of folks that makes sense for me. And to be sure, even me getting into the University of Arizona was from a relationship that actually happened with a professor who was at Penn at the time who knew folks at Arizona, right? So, like, there was definitely a gateway of sorts. I don't think it should have cost me, you know, what's now $68,000 right, that I still owe right these people. But I understood that part of it. And I always thought, right, like, I'll be successful. I'll figure out a way to pay it back. And even still having been relatively successful, right, having a decent bag, it's still there. I'm like, what have I been paying y'all for?
Literally.
I remember years and years ago asking my cousin something about his career, and he referenced his degree as a receipt. And I was like, yikes. I was like, yeah. He's like, I ain't worried about that receipt. And I was like, Oh, okay. And it made me think about it a little bit differently. I'm curious, though, for the two of you, as you think about, because I often think about like what I got out of my college experience and the people I was able to meet and what that did for my trajectory. How do you all think about your trajectories and their relationship to where you went to school? Travell, you've kind of started to touch on this and like who you get to meet and all that. And I think about this a lot at USC because I came into class a few weeks ago and the students were like, oh, I ran into Jeff Bezos downstairs yesterday and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you what? Like, Sasha Obama goes to USC and like, oh, ran into... And I'm like, there is something about the school that you go to and the trajectory the possibilities of trajectory that sets up for you.
We're not supposed to be like, you know, really comparing, you know, the schools, right? It's supposed to be you got your bachelor's, you got your bachelor's, a bachelor's, a bachelor's, a bachelor's. You're not asking your doctor where she went to school, right? For that bachelor's, right?
Well, a bachelor's. I mean...
Charles is like, can I see a transcript before I have a conversation with you about my foot?
Like, we're older now, so we really need doctors, right? I need to know that you wasn't like a C plus.
That's right? I got a mess.
Well, even that though, like, I've never been asked my GPA after I got out of school. You know what
Here,
I mean?
Thanks.
Like, never been asked my GPA. No one's. I can't remember needing my transcript for anything that I've done. And I think maybe one time me not having a degree stopped me from getting a job. I think. And that was like 15 years ago, right?
It depends on that, your field or your discipline, right? And like at what point you're entering into the job market, right? And also like what school you go to. So I think that's part of the thing. One of the things you have to remember is that the genesis of higher education, even still to this day, was to serve white, middle-class, affluent parents and students, right? And it's a resource. So much so that higher education becomes one of the more significant stratifiers within our society. It actually separates, right, people more so than it actually brings folks together. So this notion of social mobility still has a hierarchy, which means like if you go to USC, if you go to Stanford, you go to Penn or wherever, that's how people in the recruitment, right? Like you've been at SC and you see like who comes to recruit students there. And this is the thing also I didn't understand in undergrad. So we would have, you know, job fairs at Florida State, and I remember distinctively that recruiters would be really explicit, like, don't worry about hiring minority candidates here because we are going to be at FAMU next week and that's where we're going to get our folks, right? And so is this also this sort of underlying assumption that being at a white school some way would better position you than being at an HBCU, even though that's where most of the diverse recruiting was taking place. And so there is a sort of recognition that has to happen that there are hierarchies and like where you go to school matters for certain people in certain sectors, but also your work experience, right? In the same way, like the companies that you work for says something about you to move you along. So we have to recognize that higher ed, although it provides a number of things in terms of experience, it also just gives you a credential, right? A credential or a thing that allows you to like traverse certain boundaries, navigate in certain ways, because people aren't going to ask those questions. Like you graduate from Harvard, like nobody's going to really check in about the GPA situation.
Right.
Right. There's like, no, they see that.
So, Jared, this is why I have a question for you, which is, do you feel like not having the degree, like, has negatively impacted you or your career or your trajectory? Like, do you feel like you can pinpoint that? Or do you feel like, you know, you was going to be hot shit anyway?
Certainly not the latter. Travell is always like, what is former? What is latter? Ladder.
I figured it out. Ladder is later. Thank you. Don't be trying to play me on the record. Listen, but also, that's true tea.
This is where we'll run the clip of you talking about which one is which. Anyway, but I...
With a Stanford seal behind
him. Exactly, right? But do I feel like it had an impact on me? I will say that I did not recognize how much imposter syndrome I had until after the Melania story broke. Right. When I saw so many headlines about myself, laid off journalists, out of work journalists that ain't got no job, has broken this big story and blah, 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 blah. And I didn't know that I had imposter syndrome until I started panicking, seeing the word journalist attached to my name. I had always been a reporter. I was a writer. I was a producer. I was all of these other things, but I did not call myself a journalist. And I thought that I had to grow to this level to be a journalist when I was on network television or when I was on cable news or when I was, you know, doing some other thing, right? I had already been a daily reporter in a local market in Tampa Bay like the year before that, right? And so Anne had like, you know, started as a journalist in 11th grade. Travelle, I know you always say like, I'm nobody, like you didn't know people reference their journalism careers in high school. But like, I started in 11th grade as a reporter, right? I was going out interviewing folks, writing up cover stories and those kinds of things in school. But like, I still never felt like a real journalist. And so when I left school, it definitely had the impact of making me always judge myself as not being enough because I did not finish. And I've only just in the last couple of years started to be able to overcome that and like be able to respect what I was able to accomplish even without the degree. And so I don't know if I'm answering your question, but like it certainly has had an impact that I did not see until a couple of years ago.
So first off, on the point about you and your 20-year career starting in 11th grade, I was telling you when we were producing that like you are the first person who I've ever heard in this industry, right, count their high school stuff. And I'm wondering if that is also influenced by the fact that like you did not have, in the way that I had, right, this moment, right, where somebody or some institution told me, you got this paper, legit. You good, you can do this career. And right. And that didn't come until after high school, after college, after a few internships and fellowships, right? I'm wondering in my head if that's another reason why you are able, right, to like look at your career in that expansive way, because you're not bogged down, right, by what comes with having a piece of paper, crossing a stage.
I don't know when I started counting the years of my career, and including high school or not, or college or not. But like, again, I started in 11th grade on the newspaper. I was in 12th grade on the newspaper. And then in college, I was like a reporter at CAU on CAU News and all these other things, right? So I was always like doing something. I created a publication my first year at Clark Atlanta that I was sending out to folks. You know, like I was always doing something of that nature. But I also remember my last year in college, and I always remember being in this capstone journalism class, and our professor asking the class, how many of you have done interviews in here? And like, if there were 25 students, 3 people raised their hands, right? And I was like, how are you about to graduate and you ain't interviewed nobody, right? But I have been doing interviews since 11th grade. You know what I mean? Like, I have been doing this and I'm in my fourth year of college. And so it was bananas to me that I'd had so much job experience alongside all of these other students who had a lot more linear relationships to their college, or a lot more linear college journeys than I did. But that was a moment that kind of highlighted for me like, oh, I have a very different experience than most other people. And that's when I started thinking about my career as having been years long already, because I had already interviewed celebrities. I had already started a publication. I had been on television. I had done all of these things before my fourth year in college. And these other students didn't even have like any frame of reference for beginning that.
So that's the T, right? Because so much of the credential allows for people to bypass practical skill sets and applying those in ways that a lot of employers are even saying, right? Like, we're not going to recruit from here anymore because folks show up and they can't actually do anything. They know all about theory, nothing about practice, right? And I think that for me is also a thing that I didn't understand, right? It's like, I'm majoring in this particular thing, but nobody was like, oh, you should spend your summers like interning at like a newspaper or doing this or doing that. And as someone who was like super involved, we thought like student involvement was like our experience. And in a lot of ways it was, right? It prepared us to do a lot of things that we do now. But I think that's the key piece, is like, what is actual vocational preparation and training? And this is the thing I think HBCUs take much more seriously than PWIs, in part because a lot of it started as like vocational schools for us. And so there's usually this pairing of vocation that requires you do X amount of hours, right, before you graduate in certain industries. But I think that's also the thing where people lose. It's like, oh, I thought if I just had this piece of paper, I can just go get this job. And it's like, no, boo-boo, you actually have to do something else. So now you got to take an unpaid internship that you can't even afford because you got this student loan debt, which then crowds out people to have access to opportunity because you can't afford to take up the sort of level of exploitation that it requires to be successful. Mm.
You know, I think for me, I realize that like I don't want to say none of this degree shit matters, but none of this degree shit matters, right? Because for me, I think that initial realization came because, you know, all of this stock, as you were saying earlier, Charles, all of this stock goes into, you know, you want to get into a good school. You know, if you want to do this, you need to go to a school like this, right? Because of the cachet, right, that's supposed to come with that name, right? But then you end up working next to somebody who got that community college degree, right? And you now have all this fucking debt for it, right? And so, like...
and they may have more professional right. work experience than you, like, already exactly. have. Because the other piece of it for me, and I always harp on this with my students and students that I've spoken to over the years, I think those internships that I had and, like, taking the initiative to create things that would give me a platform to be able to speak gave me way more knowledge and experience and things that I was able to value than what I got in school. Right. Because again, by the time I was in my sixth year as a journalist or seventh year, because I think there was a year between Clark Atlanta and Kennesaw, if I'm not mistaken. I had already been interviewing people for 7 years, writing articles for 7 years before I even got to that class. Right. And so I always say to my students, like, make sure y'all are getting involved as interns. My students are interns at major news stations and websites and things like that, and where they're already writing stories. And I'm like, this is what's actually going to help you.
I hope they're getting paid, child. Get along.
They are, right? But, like, it's also a situation of y'all are at USC as students, right? And I always remind them of the privilege of that. Like, y'all are going to be much more likely to go be managers and editors and directors and VPs and all of those things just because you went here. Right? Not because of a whole lot of other things. And most of my students are Black and brown and predominantly women. And, like, all of those things, like, factor into where they're going to see themselves post-college and in their careers.
But how do you both, right, as we've been having a very murky conversation, right? The highs, the lows, the benefits, and the less benefits of, you know, going to college, getting these degrees and whatnot. How do you both as professors, right, like, you know, teach the babies, but also have, like, these real conversations with them as well about, like, you know, you can still be successful if this degree shit don't work? Or do you feel compelled to be having those conversations?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I feel like there's an obligation on my part to keep it real, right? Like, bear the truth. And part of that is that we don't get overly invested in these institutions or these credentials that don't care about us, right? Like, we are all disposable. They will find another number to fill that slot and pay that tuition. And I think that for me is, like, part of the conversation that has to happen, right? Is, like, understand why you're here and what you need to accomplish in order for you to get out of here, but don't be so invested in trying to change this place, right? Because you're not working about a student activist. Don't be so invested in trying to change this place when, like, it's been here for hundreds of years. It hasn't changed but so much. Right. And so you can't lose sight. And so you burn out trying to do all this extra work that isn't actually about attaining the specific thing you came from. But I think part of it is to know that, like, the degree has a value in society. So we need to be honest about what that is. But that doesn't mean that your value should be, right, wrapped up in whatever that is. And that's what I think happens. Like, say you do run into a situation as you sit next to somebody who, like, maybe did finish at a community college and has an associate's, and you want to look down on this person, even though you're the person that actually got over. Right. Because you wanted to say, like, oh, well, my degree is worth this, so I should be getting this in the marketplace or whatever the case may be. And part of that for me is that because, again, as I mentioned, these places were built primarily for white people and white families to preserve their status. Much of what we sort of are using this place for is to gain proximity to whiteness. You feel me? And part of what that means is that you have to fall out of right relationship with Black people. So my thing is, don't let this degree make you forget that you a Black person. Because, like, the police don't ask me for my degree when they stop me in my car.
They sure as hell don't.
Right. I know. Right? That's
and
right.
if I told them I was a professor at whatever school, they're not going to believe me on the first pass. Right? I mean, it's definitely true in LA. Right? I definitely got stopped by LAPD. Because, you know, I had long hair back then too. Like, what are you doing driving on USC's campus? This is happening to my students all the time. They don't ask these questions. So part of it is not to mistake the fact that because you go to these fancy places, you get these fancy pieces of paper, that you're still not a nigga in the United States, right? As Cornel West would say, like, you're going to have an experience in which you are re-nigrified, which means they're going to remind your Black ass, right? That them pieces of paper don't mean nothing. They're not going to stop the bullets from entering your body, right? They're not going to stop the stop and frisk, right? They're not even going to pan out equitably in the job market, because we know that even with the degrees that we got, we still get underpaid by our white counterparts by a whole lot. Underhired, underpaid, many of whom don't even have the same credentials, right? Even if they do, George Bush, C+ student at Yale, gets to be president of the United States. Right. So I think that's the thing, is like, don't let this experience be something that takes you further out of community, right? Further out of our relationship with the people that ultimately, when these places burn down, like figuratively or literally, right? If we're thinking about abolition as a frame, you got to go back somewhere. And if you done treated people that you didn't think was nothing because they ain't had the education you thought they had, and that's part of the problem, right? Like, we feel like that the education that we get from our grandparents, right? The folks who actually learned us about how to live in this world to survive, right? We feel like we didn't learn nothing from people who didn't have a certain type of education, even though that's the first and foremost place where we learn how to be who it is that we are. And I think that, for me, is what it all comes down to, that I need to demonstrate to you that I don't think I'm exceptional. I don't care what these people tell you about me, right? I know I'm just like you and you just like me to a certain extent. And I can't ever forget that, because I know my great-grandmother, right? If I had that conversation with her, she's going to ask me, like, how authentic have I shown up? How have I done right by my ancestors? And it's cute you got that little piece of paper, baby. What you doing for your people?
I received that. I think that's a good place for us to wrap it up. Charles, really appreciate you being a part of this conversation, and tell people where they can connect with the work that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's always a pleasure to be in community with y'all. You can check me out at hfdavis.com. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at hfdavis, and look forward to connecting with y'all on the web.
Thank you, doctor.
We're going to take a quick break. We want to hear from y'all. Hit us up on social media using the hashtag FansHighFam. We're on Twitter and Instagram at FansHighPodcast, and also on the TikTok machine. Coming up, why y'all hate us so much in listener feedback and our dishonorable mentions. We're going to be right back.
Hey, did grad school ruin your reading habits?
Oh my God, all those books you had to read for grad school.
Did becoming a parent destroy your ability to focus on a book? Did the pandemic tank the number of novels you can get through in a year?
Ugh, that happened to everyone, and we're Reading Glasses, and we're here to help.
We'll get you out of a book slump, dismantle all that weird reader guilt,
which we know you have a lot of, but most importantly, we'll help you fall back in love with reading. Reading Glasses, every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Congratulations, you've won a ticket to attend an exclusive opportunity in a relaxing environment with two lovers.
Wow. Well, this sounds like a sort of proposition of sorts, but really it's an ad for our podcast. Wonderful. It's a show we do here on Maximum Fun, where we talk about things that we like and things that we're into.
I'm Rachel McElroy, and you just heard Griffin McElroy, and we are excited for you to join us as we talk about movies and music and books.
Things like sneezing or the idea of rain.
Can you get news or information you can use?
Absolutely,
so.
You cannot, because we're here to talk to you about pumpernickel bread.
You can find new episodes on Wednesdays.
So catch the wave.
Welcome back, beautiful people. We're going to get into our listener feedback segment. We've got an email here from Ollie. This is in response to our episode last week, The Oscars Slapped, all right? In response to that Fanti conversation where we're talking about, you know,
which y'all really liked.
Apparently, shout out to y'all.
Yeah.
So Ollie says, you all did a wonderful job peeling back the layers of this incident. One perspective that I did not hear you all express, which is being discussed at length among some Black women, is the relationship that Black women have with our hair. Some may consider Chris Rock's joke as lighthearted and a compliment to be compared to G.I. Jane. However, Black women often find ourselves being the punchline for Black male comedians. Much of that humor masculinizes, there we go, Black women, and pokes fun of our appearance and mannerism. Chris Rock has a history of weaving massage noir into his comedy. We do not know if Chris Rock knew about Jada Pinkett Smith's medical condition, yet we know that Chris Rock understands the sensitive matter of Black hair. He released a 2009 documentary called Good Hair as a result of his daughter voicing her insecurities about her hair. Black women are constantly criticized and ridiculed about our hair, whether it is a weave, wig, natural, or being bald-headed. We are talking about the physical violence, which I do not condone. However, we often dismiss the harm that precipitated the response. Words cause harm. Mm. We place more burden on the person's reaction rather than the problematic behavior that set off the chain of action, which was the joke. We expect Black women to display strength while being demeaned. Growing up, being called bald-headed was never a compliment but a put-down. His joke referenced her bald head. If she had responded, she would have been deemed as angry or bitter. I hope that we move to a conversation about creating a space that women, specifically, in this case, Black women, are not required to bite our tongues and just deal with more harm. We are already required to do too much of that in our daily lives.
I mean, I don't even know what to say. I think,
yeah,
absolutely. I agree with all of that. Like, I think there's a lot of perspectives. This is actually one of those stories that very unexpectedly became one where there was more opinion and perspective than I ever could have anticipated. I mean, we never anticipated this thing happening, right? But also, there were so many differing opinions, and so many of them had validity, right? That I've been really fascinated and also exhausted with the conversation around this, but I'm agreed with you. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're gonna let the black woman in her letter stand, period. Okay. Let's move on to our dishonorable mentions. These are the stories of people that caught our attention this week that deserve a call out or a call in or whatever for their good or for their stupid. Jarrett, take it away.
Yeah. So first things first, I want to give a shout out to the documentary Genius over on Netflix. It's the story of Kanye West over the course of like 20 some odd years or something like that. I've watched 2 of the 3 episodes on flights back and forth from the East Coast to West Coast. And we've obviously done a whole episode on Kanye West here. And I've always said that I think that Kanye West is kind of one of those people that the way that we talk about him is always really frustrating to me because I think that there's all this analysis on he said this crazy thing or he did that weird thing and he did all this. But like it never has like the context of who he is, what his mental health situation is, the way that he kind of views the world. And so this documentary has been really interesting to watch because it starts, you know, before he became famous when he was like trying to get a record deal and brings us up literally until the last a couple of months here. So I would encourage folks to check it out to get a different lens on Kanye. It's really, really dope. Called Genius, spelled weirdly, but you'll find it.
I'm all right. Thank you, though.
That's what I'm talking about. So then I want to give a dishonorable mention to, we talked about Florida's Don't Say Gay bill here, a couple of weeks ago and kind of had like a much more in-depth dishonorable mentions than we'd ever really planned before. I saw this story over the last couple of days here where a teacher in Florida, she's an LGBTQ woman, the quote says from her, "I cannot teach in Florida." The rest of the headline says LGBTQ educators fear fallout from new school law. Following the enactment of what critics call the Don't Say Gay law, some LGBTQ teachers have quit the profession altogether. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is because in our conversation that we had here before, we talked about the way that this is an attempt of erasure, right? Like to the same way that we see conversations around critical race theory and, you know, taking out conversations about race from school, the idea of not being able to even like talk about queerness is an erasure that has negative impacts on children, but also on teachers and on everyday people who aren't even in the education system and the ways that we talk about them or the ways that we act like they don't exist. And the idea of teachers having to self-select out of the system. This is the point, right? We want to act like they're not there. We want to remove them from the classroom. We want to take them out of our government systems. We want to take them out of all of these different places as if they don't exist. And this is only going to harm children. We know that queer children are more susceptible to depression, higher rates of suicide, and all of those things. And like the ways that these laws are going to enact themselves, the main thing that I want to know is who is going to be measuring the mental health of these children over the course of the years to come when they have no representation or are completely erased from school books. Finally, I want to give an honorable mention to a new documentary, over on Amazon Music called For Love and Country. It is a new documentary that is talking about the origins of country music and how it started in blackness, but also looking at black country music artists that are, you know, trying to make their way in country music, but are not necessarily getting the attention or love that they should and facing some stiff racism within the country music community. The documentary comes out today. If you're listening on the day that the episode comes out on Thursday, make sure to check out For Love and Country over on Amazon. I'm going to be watching it along with y'all. I haven't seen it, but I've seen the trailers for it and read up a little bit about it, and I'm excited about it. So check that out. Travelle?
Have you actually watched Lizzo's Watch Out for the Big Girls yet?
I haven't seen it yet. I was going to watch it on the plane.
This is my first honorable mention. We've mentioned it a couple times on this show just because both of those mentions were like in advance of the show. Because, you know, we stan Lizzo over here. Shout out, right? And we also stan executive producer Micaiah Green. Shout out to you, sis. But I watched it last week over a couple days. It is so fucking good, y'all. It is on Amazon Prime. It's a reality. It's sort of like, it's basically a docu-series. It's not a reality competition show because she brings in these big girl dancers that she has like cast after they've, you know, submitted these auditions to dance behind her. And she actually starts out by telling them, there's 10 of them. She starts out by telling them, everyone's got a job if you make it to the end, right? Which I think unseats like the whole concept of competition, right? Because like now you're not competing against each other for a finite number of slots. You're really just trying to prove, right, that you can do a 90-minute, right, dance routine 5 days a week.
Can I just say, I feel like this is something that, I love that you pointed this out specifically, because I obviously, like I said, I haven't seen it yet, but I'm excited to check it out. This is something that I feel like you see in content when you have more diverse creators, right, that are thinking about what it's like to be a part of a show, what it's like to watch a series, and like the compassion that we don't see in a lot of other things. I love that.
And most importantly, right, there are fat women, right? Lizzo is a fat woman, right? Looking for these fat women to join her behind her team. And you know, Mekhiya Green, you know, I would say she's fat. I don't know what language she was using for herself, but you know, she's a big girl, right? And so like, I think that lived experience, right, behind the camera, right, informs the care that we see on screen. They've got a trans woman as part of the cast, and that's treated real like impeccably. You know, normally in these types of shows, right, they always get the trans person to like show childhood photos, right, of their, you know, pre-transition self and like do that type of story. But they didn't do that at all in this. And I just thought it was so fresh in like the way, right, that we should be like including trans narratives in these things. So I just wanted to say that. Check it out. It is so fucking good. Shout out again to Mekhiya. But my main honorable mention, I just got one for real. Okay, over the weekend, I was just scrolling on Instagram. Okay, just scrolling on Instagram. And then I see this photo.
On what?
Instagram.
How do you, is that like Minute Rice? What is Instagram?
Instagram, not Instagram.
Oh, because that was much more clear. Go ahead on.
Anyway, I was on Instagram. And I just saw this random photo posted. It was a photo of motherfucking Monique and Lee Daniels. And I said to myself, I know you shitting me. This gotta be April Fool's.
I know you shitting me.
This is what I just know. But it was too early for April Fool's, right? Or actually, I think it actually was April Fool's Day. But this is a long way of me saying that Monique and Lee Daniels have patched up their 13-year feud, right? We've talked about it on this show at length, right, already before. And I just want to say, it just warmed my fucking heart, right? And she's already got a job in a film that Lee Daniels is currently doing. Octavia Spencer was starring in it, but she had to step away because of her Apple TV show, right? And so now he cast Monique to replace Octavia Spencer. And you know, bitch, Monique about to tear it up, honey. You just
honey,
know she about to
she's going
eat.
To deliver.
Period. I'm done.
All that said, it's time for us to get into...
Black history is happening every day.
So we've heard stories over the years about Flint, Michigan and all of the shit things happening there. But I found a recent story that just came out this week about something good that's happening in Flint. This comes from Michigan Radio, the NPR affiliate there. They're saying people walking up to the entrance of the Flint City Hall will pass a statue honoring the city's first Black mayor. His name was Floyd J. McCree. He was selected mayor by the city commission in 1966 and served until 1968. Under McCree, Flint became the first city to ban housing discrimination that prevented African-Americans from buying homes in, quote, white-only neighborhoods. In 67, Mayor McCree threatened to resign when the city commission declined to adopt the open housing law, and commissioners eventually relented. The issue was later the subject of a hotly contested referendum, which narrowly was approved. There's a lot more information on Mayor McCree. I'll make sure to include the link into our episode notes. But, you know, there's plenty of stories in Flint that are not great, that we're not happy about. But this is one that I thought was really cool. So shout out to that. Before we go, I want to let y'all know, as we said, we're going to be talking about Rothaniel on Pop Culture Happy Hour next week. Keep an eye out for that in the feed. And if this conversation piqued your interest and you just want just like a little bit more of this here, go check out the episode with Dr. Charles Davis and one of my best friends, Seth Brundle. We're on talking about straight black men. It's called My Brother's Keeper or Nah. It was a really, really great conversation. And I think you should go check that out if you enjoyed our conversation with Charles today. We thank you so much for listening. We ask our listeners that are on Apple Podcasts to leave us a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you think about the show. If you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, we are on Instagram, Twitter, and coming up on TikTok at Fanti Podcast. You can use the hashtag FantiFam, or you can always send us an email to fanti@maximumfun.org.
If you would like to become a financially contributing member, okay, of the Maximum Fun family, of the Fanti Fam, you can do that at maximumfun.org/join. Our music, as always, is brought to you by the one and only Core Reese. That's CORE. And our graphics are brought to you by Ashley Nguyen. We do want to let you know the Max Fun Drive is coming up, okay? So stay tuned. We will have more information about that in the coming weeks.
Our editor is Will Hagel. Our social media producer is Melba Martinez. And our producer is Laura Swisher.
Booyaka, booyaka.
Oh. I guess this is a production of Maximum Fun. Booyaka.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.
And if you'd like to be... That was me on 15 times
MaximumFun.org/join.
That was me on times 15 speed.